From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. The Good War, the Greatest Generation. This is how we tend to talk about World War II and the U.S. role in defeating the Nazis. But it's much more complicated than that. When we left off, an elderly veteran told reporter Chris Harlan Dunaway about a little-known massacre. German prisoners of war gunned down by American soldiers. It happened during the Battle of the Bulge in a tiny Belgian town called Chinon. And that's where Chris picks up the story.
It's December when I arrive, around the same time of year as the Battle of the Bulge. Thin, icy snow covers the fields and forests. Everything is blanketed in fog so thick, you wouldn't even know the town of Chinon was here until it's practically in front of your face. After some searching in the haze, I finally find the house I'm looking for.
Oui. Bonjour, Roger, c'est Chris.
Okay, I'm coming.
Hello.
Please, come on.
How are you?
This is Roger Marquet. Roger was born just a year after the war, in a town nearby, and he sees the guys of the 11th Armored Division, guys like Frank Hartzell, as saviors, liberators.
And please.
Oh, thank you.
Take your chair.
So it came as a shock when Roger first heard rumors about what happened in Chinon, that Americans might have massacred German prisoners of war.
But I decided maybe it's not true.
He used to be a PE teacher. But after he heard about the massacre, he became a man obsessed and turned historian.
And I began my own investigation.
To understand the full story, Roger embedded with the 11th Armored Division veterans, like Frank Hartzell, who we heard from earlier. Roger knows him really well. Roger used to hang out at reunions back in the States, where he'd take guys aside and interview them alone. One by one, he pieced together what happened.
Can we walk there or should we go in a car?
Oh, in a car. You could go by walking.
Roger takes his wool driving cap down from its peg. We go get into my rental car. We're driving around in the dark. Then his arm shoots up to the window.
There's the house here where the basement and where the German were killed.
He's pointing at a farmhouse, but really he's pointing backwards in time.
Oh, wow. That's the house right there.
You want to see?
Yeah, I'll pull over here.
You can stay here.
Roger steps out into the snow. I step out onto the frosty black tarmac. Remember earlier when Frank Hartzell described crouching behind that stone wall, taking cover from a German machine gun nest? That's where we're standing. In front of us is a three-story farmhouse strung with gold Christmas lights. 80 years ago, that high-caliber German machine gun was in the basement window. An American tank shot its cannon point-blank at the house. It caught fire, the basement filled with smoke and screaming. Those are details I already knew from Frank, but there were some things Frank didn't see that day. For the rest of the story, Roger points at the cellar door.
Look at this. Do you see the against the wall?
Yes.
It's the stairs where from the guys came out. And the first one was a German medic.
Roger says it was a German medic who surrendered first, climbing out into the front yard where we're standing. He carried a white flag, and American soldiers were positioned in a sort of semicircle around him, rifles raised.
And without any words, when they saw the guy, he was killed.
American soldiers shot the medic trying to surrender.
Second one was maybe a young Belgian boy. They didn't fire, of course.
The boy made it out alive. Then another German emerged from the cellar steps, trying to surrender. With the basement on fire, one by one, German soldiers emerged, trying to surrender. And one by one, they were shot. Roger turns and I follow him. He crosses the narrow road, makes a sweeping gesture towards a small grassy embankment.
When the mayor came 3-4 days after, he came back, and the bodies were lined here, in front of here.
The German soldiers from the cellar, the ones who had tried to surrender.
And it was 19 dead, and they were put side by side.
But that wasn't all, of course. There were other German POWs staggering out of farmhouses trying to surrender. GIs stripped them of their weapons. Roger was told an American commander then barked an order.
Not here, guys, because the German could see us. Come a little bit further.
There were still German soldiers clustered in the forest just outside of town, potential witnesses. So the Americans herded their prisoners down the hill. Roger takes me down the road, past the church.
And when they arrive in the bottom of the village, the German could not see them.
We stand next to a barbed-wired fence, an anonymous empty pasture on the other side.
And Frank Hartzell said it was only this meadow.
This snowy meadow is where Frank and other veterans told Roger that all those German soldiers were gathered up.
And they shot 60. And one of them, the 11th armored guy, told me, I count this, 61, Roger.
That 11th armored guy, Steve Bugden, assured Roger. He said, I'm precise. Three testimonies from Steve, Frank Hartzell, and his friend John Fagg, who were by all accounts bystanders to the incident, estimate that Americans machine-gunned 60 German prisoners in this field. That combined with the cellar incident makes around 80 German prisoners killed after they had surrendered to Americans. 2 weeks earlier, when Germans massacred American prisoners in Malmedy, they killed 84. Chanone nearly settled the score, roughly one German life for each American life taken. Back at Roger's house, we go into his study. Right above his desk, there's a photograph of Bob Fordyce, Frank's best friend, who was killed by shrapnel when they were digging that foxhole.
So you have Bob's photograph right next to where you write.
Oh, yeah.
Roger adopted his grave, that spot where Frank and Bob dug together on the ridge where Bob was killed. It's in Roger's backyard. He built his house here for that reason and planted a tree to honor Bob. Roger tries to explain his devotion to these men.
I don't find the word in French. La seule immortalité réside dans la mémoire des vivants.
You have the mentality that as long as you remember someone...
Yeah.
They're alive.
He is alive, yeah. He's maybe not alive, but he is existing, because you speak of him. He is existing.
These American soldiers gave their lives to liberate his little corner of the Ardennes forest, where the Battle of the Bulge plowed through Belgian villages and people's lives. But one question nagged Roger. How could these saviors also kill all those unarmed Germans who surrendered? How could the Americans do what they did?
One of them tell me we became animal at the time of the combat. We became like animal, and you have to do this because if you don't have the instinct of war, you will be killed. It's not excusable, but it's explainable.
It's worth noting we're talking about Nazis here. That alone makes some of this explainable. Allied soldiers were battling for their lives. They were exhausted, living in frozen foxholes. And that's when they got the order to take no prisoners. It's hard to know who gave that order, especially since many military records from that time have been destroyed by fire. But I did uncover an important piece of evidence. In the book, The Patton Papers. It's mostly a transcription of General George S. Patton's diaries and notes. It says this about Chanone. There were also some unfortunate incidents of the shooting of prisoners. I hope we can conceal this. But I found Patton's original handwritten diary in the Library of Congress. It's been digitized. After hours of clicking through Patton's scrawl, I found the same passage, blue ink on tan pages. Except this passage is different. It has a misspelled word, med instead of men. More importantly, there's a number. I read it aloud to Roger, slowly.
Also, murdered 50-odd German med. I hope we can conceal this.
That's the document that was sent. Where did you find this? Pen and paper, maybe. Whoa.
Roger is surprised because this diary entry seems to prove something he had long suspected. Patton knew his troops had murdered Germans, at least 50. Not long after, we say our goodbyes.
Merci.
Merci, Chris.
All right, bye-bye.
I learned that the Patton papers were written by a historian named Martin Blumensohn. He worked for the army, and he was given unlimited access to all of Patton's documents. He died in 2005. How important was it that a historian who worked for the army didn't transcribe Patton's exact words? I went back to the States to find out.
Chris.
Hi.
How are you?
Good, how are you? Nice to meet you, Bill.
I was looking for you. But
Bill Johnson is a military historian and former dean of the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. We walked past paintings of musket charges and the cavalry riding in. Then Bill points me to a plaque with Martin Blumensohn's name on it.
I did check. Martin Blumensohn was here. The Harold K. Johnson visiting professor of history from 75 to 76.
That's the year after he published the Patton papers. Bill starts walking down the hallway again.
Did you know Martin Blumensohn yourself?
No, I have never met him.
Okay. So I know him clearly by reputation.
Bill is heading into a conference room. It's got funky faux wood paneling. We sit down at the table side by side and swivel our office chairs to face each other. I pull out a folder holding my documents and pick out Blumensohn's transcription, the one that reads, "There were some unfortunate incidents of the shooting of prisoners. I hope we can conceal this." Then I pull out a printed copy of Patton's original diary in his handwriting, which clearly says, "Also murdered 50-odd German med." Bill inspects them.
If you were doing a transcription of Patton's papers, what would you have done?
At this time, I think I would have probably looked at, from a historian's perspective, this is a relatively small, isolated incident, far out of relevance to the bulk of the other material that's there. And so he may have just made a generalization.
Does it come across as sanitized in any way to you?
I'm sure that some people would immediately look at this and say, oh, look, he concealed the number. Others might look at it and say, no, he didn't know what the number was. He had a single report. We have a truism in the military, which is never believe the first report. And so the question in Blumensohn's mind may have been, I don't know what the real number is, so I'll keep it general.
Do you think people who approach it thinking that it's just a transcription of what Patton wrote verbatim, do you think they have some right to be disappointed?
Well, I don't, again, I think that if you look at some of these issues, some of it is, I'm sure that editors were trying to portray a broad, positive picture. And so sometimes these things get shaded. Winners usually get to write the history and get to determine what's good or evil.
He's saying it's complicated, so cut Blumensohn a little slack. So I pressed one last time for answers about what happened in Chinon.
Is this, like, clearly a war crime?
Well, under the law of land warfare, yes. Once people surrendered, they've surrendered. And so there are clear definitions of what constitutes surrender and not surrender, what constitutes a combatant and a non-combatant. And all of these activities are reinforced, at least on an annual basis, throughout the Army.
The same rules are in the Geneva Conventions. Both Germany and the United States had signed them before World War II. Bill says U.S. soldiers must follow orders, but they also have a higher responsibility.
Every soldier has the responsibility to disobey an unlawful order.
Every soldier has the responsibility to disobey an unlawful order. But if it was unlawful, if it was clearly a war crime, who was supposed to investigate it, and why wasn't it ever prosecuted?
When we come back, Chris talks to a war crimes investigator who argued one of the biggest murder trials in human history. That's coming up on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.